Hey there, and welcome to Money for Change, the podcast where we dive into the sustainability transitions that are reshaping our world. If you're curious about where the planet and its inhabitants are headed, you're in the right place. In each episode, we'll chat with experts from Triodosbank whose work relates to these changes, tackling topics like the energy transition, circular economy, and what sustainable finance really means. Our goal? To bring you the latest insights on what it takes to create a more balanced and just world. But we don't just want you to listen. We want you to be part of the conversation. Head over to our website via the link in the show notes to share your thoughts, ask questions, or leave us a voice message. Welcome to Money for Change. Let's get started. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emma De Leo. I'm one of the three hosts of the Money for Change podcast next to Sanna and Ernst. Welcome to this week's episode, already the fourth episode. Thank you for tuning in. In recent weeks, our global events have dominated the headlines, hinting at challenges and changes that could shape the future. But today, I want to focus on a social issue that affects every single one of us, aging. It's a reality that no human can escape. And with people living longer than ever before, and for the first time, there are more elderly people than young children in the world. So that brings us to our key question. How do we provide quality healthcare for a rapidly aging population, also given a declining birth rate and a declining workforce? The fundamental demographic transition, as it's more commonly called, is represented by an aging population, and it will impact healthcare and social systems, labor markets for healthcare workers, public finances, and of course, pension entitlements. Joining us to unpack these questions is Maverick Webstock, head of the well-being transition at Triodosbank in the United Kingdom. Maverick, head of the well-being transition, can you quickly explain what this role entails?
Hi, Emma. Yeah, great to join you today. I head Triodos's well-being transition team and a manager coverage team with presence across the UK, including London and the South East, the Midlands, South West and the North of England, as well as Scotland and Wales. The lending sectors under well-being include healthcare, education, recreation, sustainable tourism, arts and culture, and philosophy of life.
Philosophy of life. I want to know more about philosophy of life.
Awesome.
Let's do that later.
Okay.
And then, as always, as you can already hear, we've got Hans Steegman, Chief Economist at Triodosbank, also joining us.
Thank you, Emma.
Welcome, welcome. All right. Before we dive into the key question, I want to ask the question, you know, why is our population aging? And why are we discussing it today in this podcast? Hans.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest topics, of course, aging population. And this is one of the things that many Western countries, because I think we should restrict ourselves to Europe, that's what we do here, know already for a very long time. Mm-hmm. We know the baby boom just after World War II, and we see declining fertility rates, which is also partly a good thing, because if women get higher educated, more participate in the labor force, they most of the time have less children. But that means that in the end, currently, more than one-fifth of European population is older than 65, with a ratio of 3 working-age individuals to each older person. And it's expected to become 2-1 in 2050. And it has a lot of implications economically and socially. Less healthcare workers available for increasing demand for healthcare. Mm-hmm. Higher cost of healthcare because we have older people who need more care. Lower public revenues because of a shrinking labor force, less people paying taxes. And it also implies changing preferences for consumption, leisure, and housing. So a lot of structural changes in the economy are coming. And the stupid thing is, but that's always with politics, we already knew it for a long time.
Yes, seems like this one we can also really predict. All right, so you've already answered my next question, you know, which countries are affected? So this is mainly geared towards...
It's Europe, and if you look at Europe, it's the more to the east you go, the heavier the effect. So if you go to Russia, and Eastern Europe, then aging is far more reaching the eastern part of Germany, and then it's coming closer to the UK, where we end. Yeah. But also, it's not typically only Europe, it's also China, for instance, with one-child politics, which has a much faster demographic transition, which makes it much more complicated to get things organized there.
All right. And Japan, of course. I think that's always
Japan, because for Japan, we already know it for decades. And we also see a little bit how that goes, right? With an economy that is aging. What you see there, for instance, in the housing market that you have on the rural areas that you just have abandoned houses at least, but sometimes even neighborhoods. And that maybe that's also a little bit of our foreland.
Yeah. Before we dive into what we predict, I think we see the aging population, obviously the birth decline, but what you do see in kind of the charts, the main thing that's keeping the overall population growth up is immigration. Yep. So, you know, what is the role there? Is it an opportunity to kind of resolve these kind of issues?
It's a difficult, especially at this time in Europe, when you see that, let's say, the pro-immigration sentiment is not so large.
Yeah.
To say this is a solution. If you look more from an economic perspective, it's a delay. It's not a structural solution, because then you get inflow of new workforce, but then they also age if they stay there. Yeah. So it's not a final solution. But of course, in a transition, you can think of, hey, we need extra hands. How can we help here with new people? What you see in Europe is that immigration within Europe aggravates the problem in Eastern Europe, because people from Bulgaria or from Romania come to work in Western economies, like in the Netherlands or in Germany. And then
there's
the
less
problem.
Young people there to fill up the labor shortages, for example. So a complex challenge, not so clear solutions right away. But I think the point of this podcast, the focus, because it's the one that, you know, can take any way, is really looking at the healthcare. So in the context of one of the changes, the increase in demand for elderly care, as Hans laid out, Maverick, what are the main challenges that we're facing in providing adequate care?
Yeah, I think, well, Hans has laid it out really well. Little or very small population growth over the next 30 years and an elderly population, which is in itself aging, so that the 85 plus age group will more than double by 2050. You will see a continued demand for elderly care. But, you know, this is against the backdrop of workforce shortages driven by a shrinking economically productive population, the recent inflationary pressures, cost pressures that we've seen, and competition for labor with other sectors, increased chronic illness prevalence with people entering care facilities. They enter the facilities later in life, but they then have higher care needs. And this puts strain on healthcare infrastructure, especially hospitals, where elderly patients can block beds, is what they call it in the UK, for lengthy periods if there are no alternative facilities available to meet their needs and get them out of the hospital system. And again, lack of resources in rural areas and insufficient preventative care. It's not just about treating the problem when it arises, but how do you prevent it arising?
Yeah, I think that's quite a number of things. I think the question, bringing back in the transitions and transformation aspect, you know, are we at a tipping point, would you say, Maverick?
Yeah, I think we are at a tipping point. But as Hans said, it's something that we have known for a while. It's something that has been on the horizon. And it is really up to each country how they deal with it. I don't think all responses are going to be the same. I think it's going to be a blend of public and private sector responses to a problem that's been coming for a long time and has been known about for a long time.
And as I think Hans said, we're very distracted by the short-term problems that we're facing, that this such a predictive potential challenge is not being adequately addressed. Is that a safe statement to say? Is there enough attention on this topic or?
No, I think healthcare is changing. Certainly what we see and with the kind of organizations that we are looking to fund, it is really about preventing. It is about allowing people to live longer, healthier lives without becoming sick or having the need for the same level of medical interventions. I think we've got to address both sides of the equation.
And then you also mentioned private investment. So when I did a little bit of research preparing for this, there's a lot of talk, and you hear it in the news, public, private. it's a whole bunch of bureaucracy that's all very different in each country, even within our five European countries. Every healthcare is organized differently. A question for Hans, does private investment in healthcare always improve the healthcare?
Not necessarily so.
Okay.
And I think I've also one graph, and I think a lot of people know it, and maybe we can put it in the show notes. I don't know if that will work, but we can try. If you look at healthcare expenditure, there's always one country that stands out, that does everything completely different, mm-hmm. and that's the United States. So the healthcare expenditure per capita is by far the highest, and if you to look at life expectancy in the US, it's not better. It's even worse than in a lot of European countries.
Yeah.
So this is the example that you see that it matters quite a lot how you organize healthcare expenditure. What do you do privately? What do you do publicly? It also matters quite a lot if you do things privately, how you ensure that also your public interest, so just affordable, good healthcare,
yeah.
is guaranteed. And we have a lot of examples of private equity buying hospitals or whatever and just being only extractive. Mm. So buying the premises, diminishing the cost, making everything efficient, not looking at the patients, not looking at the good quality and accessible healthcare. So we have a lot of examples, I think, quite a lot in the Netherlands, but probably in the UK, we have also kind of that kind of examples. And then you see that it's almost always also funded by public money, right? So then you have insurers, so healthcare insurers, and then that money in the end is the profit of private capital. And how we ensure those kind of public needs, so good, accessible healthcare, elderly care, to make sure that if we do it privately, it can be done privately, but if we do it privately, that we do it also in the right way. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have here. And it matters quite a lot, and that's what we also see, that it differs, and that's what we also know as Triodos Bank from the different countries we're active in. It matters quite a lot what the regulation is in a certain country. So what is good yeah. private finance and what can be done yeah. as a private financier?
Just for the listeners, I'm going to have a little sub-conclusion. So the big issue with the aging population, or otherwise known as the demographic transition, it's a very predictable challenge that's coming at a lot of European countries, not just limited to Western Europe, but also across Europe and also in Asia. There's issues with rising demand for healthcare, outdated systems, differing regulations, and limited resources. And this will have an impact on anything from the healthcare and social care systems to labor markets for healthcare workers, but also, as Hans mentioned, public finances, pension entitlements, and also the market there. Now let's shift gears and let's talk about some solutions. So with an aging population, you have various complex challenges, as we just heard. And that really does require, I guess, a shift in the way we perceive and expect elderly care. Maverick, from your experience, how has elderly care already changed to meet those challenges?
Yeah, I think it is an evolution. Is it enough? Have we gone far enough? I don't think so as yet. But, you know, if you look at the elderly care facilities that we finance as Triodos, we need them to provide transformative care services that are future-focused and fit for purpose and incorporating the key aspects like holistic elderly care, offering residents the best quality of life, freedom of choice, integration into their communities where they've spent their whole lives, allowing them to pursue their hobbies, their philosophical pursuits, and physical activities that they enjoy. So allowing them to be the best version of themselves that they can be in their later years. You know, this is in terms of the underlying pillars of our Triodos well-being transition, which calls for healthy, free, and inspired people who are able to live holistically healthy lifestyles, exercise freedom of choice, and pursue self-development. And of course, these facilities need to embrace specialized nursing care because more people are coming into the facilities later and people stay at home or go to a support care facility and then a care home is for more intensive care needs for a shorter time towards the end of their lives. If I can just give you some options or potential areas to relieve pressure on elderly care facilities, So basically allowing people to live healthier, longer lives with lower medical care needs by preventing the incidence of chronic and lifestyle diseases. This in turn lets people remain economically active for longer, and it offsets that aging-dependent demographic. So for example, you could retrain people on retirement to full alternative careers, which is something we haven't looked at yet. Allowing people to be able to access affordable, flexible, and effective healthcare according to their individual needs, given there will be fewer carers in a shrinking, economically active population. And then encouraging things like intergenerational care facilities, mixing care facilities with other community services. Telehealth is an area that's not been that well explored as yet, certainly in the UK, or self-service using technology so people can remain independent in their own homes for longer. And then using things like technology in care facilities to reduce the administrative burden on care workers, which allows them to focus on the true person-to-person care and interaction that their roles call for.
Yeah, I think that I was going to say the first part that you were saying, healthy, inspired, and free people, I think any human at any age would aspire to kind of live by those pillars.
Is that the philosophy of life then? Because I still have that in the back of my mind. What is the philosophy of life?
So philosophy of life is really your choice of worship and worship practice. So philosophy of life is what is the philosophy that you pursue in your life, be it a religion, be it a way of thinking, what drives and guides your principles.
Is that typical for Triodos Bank to think about this in your financing practices? I'm just curious.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, so first of all, we do fund philosophy of life organizations, which would be things like various places of worship. But also when we're looking to fund a care home or a healthcare facility, we would want them to be able to offer people the choice to worship and pursue the philosophy that they have. So if the person is a Buddhist, do they have access? Do they facilitate visits to a Buddhist center or Christian or Islamic, Hindu, whatever the case may be? How do they allow people to pursue those philosophical interests? How do they integrate it into their care facility?
Okay, interesting. So you learn something from a podcast.
Yeah.
Nice.
Indeed.
Yeah, very, very holistic approach, I think it sounds like. And then I also wanted to just look at the people remaining economically active or productive for longer. I mean, that's kind of a big challenge that you can foresee. Yeah, can you elaborate a little bit on that? I mean, I know there's child labor laws, you know, are there going to be laws against over-employing maybe the elderly? I'm just joking there, but... Can you elaborate a bit more how that happens? Because, you know, in older age, maybe you have less desire to work or have a different career, as you're saying.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got to be flexible. We need to appreciate that elderly people who are adults, obviously, they're not children. So
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think, therefore, that child labor law applies, that they have the flexibility to be able to work. They may not want to be working 40-hour weeks. Perhaps it's a 15-hour week or a 20-hour week. But the point is this, for me, as a person who actually loves engaging with elderly people, the knowledge and the experience they've got is so incredibly valuable to our economies and to the different generations. How do we get them to engage across generations and remain engaged, whether it's helping children from the local primary school read or helping them to put on their plays? There's so much amazing knowledge and experience that they have to pass on. We need to give them the opportunities to be able to pass on that knowledge, because otherwise we lose it forever. So for me, and most elderly people are really willing to be engaged and they're very keen to pass it on. So how do we build and nurture that enthusiasm that they have, especially for the intergenerational exchange of knowledge and experience?
Yeah, very well said. And then I wanted to go a bit more into the practical questions. You know, we are a bank. We do have financing requirements.
And this podcast is called Money for Change.
And it's called Money for Change, exactly. Are these kind of opportunities? They're obviously interesting to finance, but, you know, are they easy to finance? What are the considerations?
So first of all, you know, when you want to fund any sector, you need to look at demand. Is there a continued and growing demand for healthcare and elderly care? Absolutely, there is. I think the big issue for us is it's a key financing sector for most banks within the UK, certainly, and I'm sure in Europe as well. The real issues are how do we structure and fund our healthcare models cost effectively and efficiently to make sure that holistic quality care is available to everyone who needs it. As Hans has said, the private sector is good at doing many things. It's good at introducing efficiency, but, you know, are we able to do that cost effectively and available for everyone who needs it, those who can afford it and those who may not be able to afford it? And I think in terms of how that's done, I don't think there's one single solution. I think it will differ from country to country. And I think depending on the care level, the solutions may suit private or public operation, but the requirements will always be the same, where we would like to see each individual nurtured and valued at each stage of their life. That pretty much summarizes it from my point of view.
And Maverick, can you tell us about maybe one example in your portfolio that you're the most proud of?
Well, yes, I can. I'm not going to name names, but if I look at a new generation facility that we funded, where we have a highly sustainable home, EPCA rated, and the whole home is built around the concept of community integration. So, for example, you have activity coordinators in the home who would actually ask residents, what would you like to do? What pursuits do you want to engage in? So it's the choice that they give to people right up front. Your activity coordinator would then go away and manage your activities for you based on your desires and needs. And it's everything in there. So this home particularly is built next door to a primary school so that there is able to be interaction with the children, because that intergenerational exchange is very key. So they've chosen a great location. And it's everything. It's from volunteering in the local community, access to religious organizations. I just think that the way it's integrated into the community is really key for me. Physical exercise, gardening, hobbies, crafts. It really does allow people to fulfill their best lives right in their final years. And of course, still offers things like medical and nursing care for when they need it.
This reminds me on the phrases we always use for healthcare, that we say that we need good quality of basic services. But like you yes. described here, it's the good quality is more than the basic service in terms of medical care. It's about, and that's why I come back to the philosophy of life. So also, but also the quality of life is very important. And I really like this story because I think if you look from such a perspective to what kind of healthcare do we want, it's more asking the question, what kind of life do we think people would aspire when they're old? Which is a completely different question.
Yeah, Hans, it's actually, you've hit on an absolutely key point. It's about living. It's about being in that home, in those care facilities, and actually living your best life, doing the things that you want to, pursuing the interests that you're keen on, doing the physical activities that you love, and making a contribution to society and to the community that you live in. It is really about that. It's about how do you live to the fullest extent while still having your care needs met.
Perfect. I think, Maverick, you've summed it up excellently. I don't think I could do a better job myself. I think maybe one thing I might add, though, at the end is also a mindset change. We really started this podcast saying, you know, aging population, it's a challenge. These things are all going to come at us. But also what you highlight is really, you know, the wisdom that is there and also still the human force that is available in those.
Yeah, if I may add to that, instead of saying this is a cost problem for society, you can also phrase it, how can we make the best of it for everyone?
Yeah.
Which
Absolutely.
Is a completely different approach.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the positive side of things. And I think there is just so much that we could gain as society out of it. Yeah.
Great. All right. So we're going for the goal of providing people with the highest quality of care for the longest period of time. It can be achieved with a change of mindset of how we perceive elderly care and live more generally. And these are things like increased financing of prevention, projects and services, semi-autonomous individuals. So I think that's great that this kind of mindset has and is being increasingly adopted for care facilities. We are going to switch over now because we've got Hans's weekly news update. Hans, tell us.
Yeah, maybe for the listeners, Emma always pushed me to bring good news, but I failed again today.
It's okay. I think this was already very heartwarming.
Yeah, we did the good part. We're recording this on Monday, the day after the ending of the COP29, so the climate COP. And this podcast is called Money for Change. And what's the conclusion is of this COP, there is not enough money for change.
Nope.
So the developing world will receive at least 1.3 trillion a year in funds to help them. That's the agreement. And by 2035, which is definitely not enough because only 300 billion is from government, public money. And 1 trillion has to come up from somewhere else, private money, they don't know. And only that 300 billion, yeah, I have to be more precise, that 1 trillion can also be public, but then we don't know what. Mm-hmm. And that 300 billion will be grants and low interest loans from the developed world.
And that's what the developing world would prefer, right?
Yeah, they want to, they ask for all of it in terms of grants,
yes,
and low interest loans, because this is what they need.
Because the private sector only really locks them in longer with debt cycles.
And we don't know how to organize it. Yeah. And there's also another strange thing. So if you want to ask a minister from a developed world country, like from the Netherlands or the UK or whatever, do you have to pay more?
Yeah.
Then they all say, no, we don't think so. So even although they have agreed that the developed world in total would pay more, so they pay now 100 billion and it would step up to 300 billion, it would mean that we have to pay more,
yeah,
we as rich people, but it's not clear. And why is this bad news? Because the idea was that if we have an agreement on finance this year, next year in Brazil, we can build on it to make better and deeper arrangements also with developing countries, and that they would give up some of their carbon budget. And that's not going to happen. I think we really have to think better if we want to organize this kind of stuff again in an oil state like Azerbaijan, where we see the lobbying of the fossil fuel industry. So it's not talking about phasing out anymore.
No. And this is key, because the hosting country is the one that drafts the first draft.
Yes.
And that's why having an oil state is actually kind of a conflict of interest to draft a climate agreement.
Definitely. So the hope is for next year on Brazil, which is a completely different country, which has a big interest. And also, at least as we have the government from Lula in place, they're now already really active. So let's hope for next year that it will be better. But this COP season, so we had COP29 and we had COP16 on biodiversity, where we talked on the first podcast on, it's not a good COP season.
Okay. And always to try and bring a little tinge of hope, are there any countries or industries that, you know, say it's not happening at a global level, we'll take more responsibility? I know Triodos is part of the Global Banking Alliance on Values-Based Banking.
Yeah, what we also signed the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. We also did in the Netherlands, together with a lot of NGOs, a citizens initiative to phasing out fossil fuel. So we have enough signatures. And I think somewhere in December, we're going to bring it to Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things happening all over the globe, initiatives, also countries that also the Netherlands, but some other countries also wanted to phase out fossil fuels, subsidies, which is also part of it. But progress, to be honest, you try it again, Emma, but progress is very limited. It's very hard to be optimistic on this.
Yes. Okay. Well, with that, I want to thank you, Maverick, for joining us and giving us really great insights into how we can approach elderly care when facing the situation or opportunity of an aging population. So thank you for your insights.
Thanks for the opportunity. Good to chat with you both.
And Hans, thank you for your insightful news. Unfortunate, but there's nothing you can do about that.
Try again next week.
But I do like your Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Citizenship Initiative. For all the listeners out in the Netherlands, there is still also actions that you can take, such as signing the treaty so that it's brought forth in Parliament. And thank you again for joining this week. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of Money for Change podcast. And of course, as always, stay tuned for next week's episode.
That's a wrap for this episode of Money for Change. We hope you found today's conversation insightful and inspiring as we continue to explore the transitions that are shaping our world and our future. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for tuning in to Money for Change.